Imagine being told that you won't survive without a new heart, or you won't ever see again without new corneas. Imagine knowing that your entire future depends on somebody else donating those organs, but that the chance of that actually happening is extremely slim. That is the reality for thousands of South Africans who find themselves living suspended lives, waiting for an organ that might never come. Around 4,000 people are on the waiting list at any time. Yet less than 1% of South Africans have registered as potential donors. If it was you or your loved one, wouldn't you do anything you could to change those odds? Welcome to A Gift of Life, a podcast series that examines the subject of organ donation in South Africa and asks what we can do to improve the chance of a second chance for those patients. I'm your host, Pippa Hudson, and over the course of this series, I'll be sharing stories of organ and tissue recipients, donors and their families, as well as the doctors, transplant coordinators and other professionals who help turn one family's tragedy into another family's greatest hope. I hope we'll address many of your questions around organ and tissue donation and perhaps inspire you to sign up as a donor yourself. In our previous episode, we spoke about tissue donation and we introduced you to the many different ways in which human tissue can be used to save or profoundly change the lives of others. Today, I want to put a human face to that story as we meet a tissue recipient. Her name is Amanda Seacombe, and she is the recipient of two donated corneas. Now, Amanda is able to live a full and productive life because two complete strangers made the decision to register as tissue donors. It was a decision that profoundly changed her life. Amanda, before you started experiencing issues with your vision, had you ever thought about organ and tissue donation? Had you discussed it with your loved ones? Had you thought about whether it was something you would do one day?
Yes, I was signed up as an organ and tissue donor already. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so then you were obviously aware of the fact that tissue such as corneas could be transplanted as well as major organs.
I don't know that I was that aware of corneas so much.
Really?
You know, I mean, obviously there's a lot more talk around heart recipients, kidney recipients, so perhaps, the eyes hadn't come into my, pardon the pun, field of sight or vision, but definitely organ donation was something that was, I was very aware of and already signed up for.
Okay, but probably never imagined that you would need yourself one day.
No, definitely not.
Now, take us back to late 2018. I know you'd had a really busy year running your online business. You were starting to look forward to the Christmas holidays, having a bit of a break, and then quite out of the blue, you started experiencing some discomfort. Tell us what had happened. Had you had any kind of eye trouble before that?
I had. I'd had complex eyes, and I'd had a partial cornea graft a couple of years before that. So okay. I was born with a very high astigmatism, and I was quite short-sighted. So okay. I wore glasses, and I wore contact lenses.
Okay.
This was completely different. This was serious discomfort, pain, and rapid vision loss. Started on the 6th of December, and the reason I remember that date so clearly was I remember meeting my sister, and I had dark glasses on, and she said, "We're sitting inside, what's with the dark glasses?" Yeah. I said, "My eyes are just so sensitive to light, and they're so sore and so scratchy, and I'm on my way to see the optometrist." And he felt it was allergy-related, there's lots of pollen in the air.
Yeah.
Dryness, so just go home, keep your eyes, maybe don't wear your lenses for a bit, keep your eyes moist. And 2 days later, I was back saying, "No, this vision loss is happening and there's something else going on here."
Sure.
And I'm really uncomfortable. Yeah, and to cut a long story short, I then saw an ophthalmologist who thought that there was possibly a bit of an ulceration initially. Again, a couple of days later, pain was really bad. Vision was rapidly fading. And then a diagnosis, unfortunately, was made of a fungal infection. And that kind of added fuel to the fire because they use steroids to treat fungal infections.
Mm.
And so I sat over the Christmas period with steroid eye drops and being treated for fungal infection, which was an incorrect diagnosis. And by December the 25th, I was in so much pain, I was crying. I was literally in floods of tears. I've never experienced so much pain and absolutely blind. And I was assured that the sight would come back. So the treatment that they'd put me onto, the fungal infection, would last for 3 weeks and it would turn around, and we guarantee you this is, it's all going to turn around and everything will be fine. And of course, 3 weeks in, things had just got worse. Yeah. And this pain was just mind-blowing, which I kind of now understand, because I had basically living amoeba eating my corneas.
Oh.
And so your nerve endings in your eyes are exceptionally rich and dense. And here were these horrible little monsters just chomping away, feeding off my corneas. And that was the pain.
And that was the excruciating pain you were experiencing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, to discover that that was actually what was going on, I mean, it's an extraordinary story, and we've told before on the radio station, but let's just recap. I was interviewing an ophthalmologist specialist from Tygerberg Hospital on the radio one day, talking about advances in treatment of corneal conditions. And a friend of yours happened to catch that interview, Amanda, and phoned you and said, maybe you should go and see this guy. I mean, it's such a just the fortuitous serendipity, I guess is the word I'm looking for, of those connections happening that took you to the right person who was able to get you to the right diagnosis. By what date was that? How long had you waited to get that appointment?
I think if I recall correctly, seeing him on the 13th of February.
February, you've been in agonizing pain for weeks by now.
Yeah.
Unable to see the impact on your life, your ability to run your business, to live a normal life. Can you just try and sum up for us what you were going through from that perspective?
It was terribly frightening. The uncertainty of what was going on, not knowing, but having a gut feeling that the initial diagnosis was on the wrong path, and not feeling particularly held in terms of medical treatment. My family were amazingly supportive and stayed with me for 3 weeks in December just to help me with, you know, general getting around and housework and trying to keep me calm. Unfortunately, at that stage, I didn't have any pain relief. But when my sister came back from her leave, she's a psychiatrist, and she came back from her December leave, and she said, we really need to contain this pain. What I would suggest is we look at a pain that is used in psychiatry for neurological conditions so that we can get this pain under control. And then you can kind of rest a little bit, you know, because I couldn't get outside. The light sensitivity was so severe that even in my bedroom, I had to wear one of those aeroplane
masks
and all my blinds and windows were blacked out. So that any like shard of light that shone through would just send my eyes into absolute like, the most stabbing pain. So it was a really hard time emotionally, and when my family could no longer stay, they had to go back to PE. We found a carer who moved in with me. I had a lovely young carer with me for about 5 weeks, and then unfortunately she had to go overseas, so it was back to finding another carer, and that carer didn't really work out after about a month. And then it was transplant time, so I kind of felt a little more hope, I suppose, which allowed me to think I can do this on my own. If I navigate around my house and I put things in place that can help me get through the day.
Yeah.
So frozen meals were provided, stickers were stuck on my computer keyboard so that I could find my password using my fingers.
Yeah.
And I learned some voiceover techniques through a girl who's blind who lives in Plumstead. She's been blind since birth.
Yeah.
And she does training part-time on Apple Mac technology.
Incredible.
So you can use assistive touch. And I got training from her, so I kind of could get back into using my computer a little bit and connecting, I suppose, with people, you know, not feeling so vulnerable.
Yeah. But literally having to, restructure your entire life to accommodate this dramatic loss of vision.
Yeah.
And as you say, it must have been so terrifying in those early weeks when you didn't know whether you were going to get it back. And then the moment that changes it all, that you're sitting in the doctor's office of that Tygerberg consultant, and you are told, actually, this is not a fungal infection. What you have is, in fact, something entirely different. Won't you explain what that diagnosis was?
So what I had is acanthamoeba keratitis, and acanthamoeba are free-living organisms, amoeba, as the name describes. It is a waterborne and airborne and soil-borne parasite. So where the contamination came in, we're not sure. It's likely to have been contact lens related. I may have washed my face with my contact lenses in. I may have had a swim with my contact lenses in. I may have had a shower with my contact lenses in. We'll never know. That's the most likely
source of it is
water. Water and contact lenses are not good friends. Okay. And every optometrist out there should be telling people that. Because I think people just are quite casual. You know, you might rinse your lens case, for example, with tap water, and knowing that you might have a little drop of some infected bug that's going to get in there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was the diagnosis that they made. Started the correct treatment immediately, but also insisted that I had biopsies just to confirm the diagnosis. So they took scrapings under anesthetics and under anesthetic, and then actually confirmed that that was the case. And then said to me, you're in for probably 2 years of visual rehabilitation.
Okay.
So you need to kind of plan your life accordingly. 2 years turned into 3 years, unfortunately, in my case, but that's just unlucky.
Okay.
After my transplants, I developed cataract blindness as a result of steroid treatment again. So, you know, these blooming steroids, but anyway,
gotta
love them, gotta hate them, yeah. Mm. So, yeah, that was the diagnosis, and I mean, that was really down to that contact with Cape Talk and the interview you had with Prof. Smit.
It's, I mean, just incredible serendipity that it all came together. Mm. Now, the treatment I know initially was quite painful, eye drops that you had to take with huge discipline multiple times a day. But, of course, you'll do that to get you to the possibility of getting your sight back. Mm. At what point did the doctor say to you, I think a transplant is actually going to be your best option?
That was always going to be the only solution.
Okay.
But they couldn't do the transplant until the infection had kind of calmed down. So what these acanthamoeba do, as soon as they start treating with this very, very hectic low concentration pool acid effectively, plus another four different drops on top of that. So they try and quieten it down, but as soon as you apply that to the eyes, they form cysts and they go into hiding. So killing them is an absolute nightmare. So you closely monitored, obviously there are other telltale signs. They watch the sort of whether your eyes still purulent, whether it's red, whether it's light sensitive, and they can gauge whether it's calmed down and the point at which, okay, now you're almost doing a transplant, I think, to remove the remaining diseased cells as well as give you a new cornea.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, Amanda, waiting for a cornea, how long did you have to wait? Was one available as soon as you were ready to need one? How did that process
Fortunately
work?
For me, that was not a long wait. The corneas that I received were both from the States, so they came from an American eye bank.
Mm.
And I think I was very fortunate that I was just prior to COVID.
Right.
Or not just prior, but at least 6 months prior to COVID. If it had been 6 months later, I would have been sitting waiting.
Yeah.
Because there was no tissue being transferred across. And
Why as far afield as America? Were there none available locally, or do you want to explain?
None available locally.
Yeah.
None available locally. That's the sad part, is we have such a shortage of corneas in South Africa. Despite the number of deaths that we have on our roads and murders and all the rest, and the number of people who could actually be registered as cornea donors, we should be in a position where we could be, you know, processing everybody's needs.
Meeting all need, yeah.
So we are really reliant on overseas eye banks. America is one of the top sources, and I believe that in the month of August, Italy becomes a good source for some of the ophthalmologists, because that is high summer and surgeries calm down in Italy, so they then don't do as many ops there, and they've got an oversupply of corneas. So,
how interesting. Yeah. Okay. Mm. Isn't it strange? Yeah. The things that can influence who waits for how long.
Exactly, yeah.
So the transplant process itself, the operation, the recovery, do you want to tell us a little bit about what that was like for you?
Sure. So the first operation was in April 2019, and I received donor tissue from a 33-year-old young American woman who'd passed away from cancer. The up was, very uneventful in terms of, you know, going in. You go in day surgery, literally.
Really?
I didn't stay in, and then back the next day for a checkup. You feel, your eyes feel very scratchy because you have all these sutures in your eyes.
Of course,
so
yeah.
They typically use 18 sutures to keep the, 16 to 18 sutures to keep the cornea in place. And you're obviously on a whole lot of eye drops again. Mm-hmm. After that, you have a shield that you wear over your eye for a month to protect you, particularly at night, because you don't want to rub or knock anything or cause any damage. And I wore it outdoors as well because I have a very bouncy golden retriever. I was so concerned he was going to headbutt me. And I did one at a time, right?
Okay.
So they did the left eye, which was the worst eye. They did that first. So then it's a case of, watching for rejection. Mm-hmm. So you are closely monitored to see that there's nothing funny going on, that the cornea is taking well. And the next hurdle after that is, waiting for your sutures to be removed, which is 18 months after
that.
Long?
Yeah.
So in the initial phases, probably within the first 2 to 3 months, I had the most phenomenal vision out of my left eye. And this is the thing with cornea transplants, is they mold and they morph as time goes on. And so after about, I think it was about 6 months, my vision suddenly started to decrease again. And I was, hell,
that must be a huge
what's
interest,
going on here? You know, like this is, I'm actually... like it's getting worse. And then when I had my sutures removed, it got even worse. So my left eye, I've had a great result in terms of getting a smooth cornea surface, but I haven't got vision out of that cornea. So I've only got 5% in my left eye without the help of my scleral lens.
Okay.
So that's where my passion for these customized scleral lenses comes from, because my scleral lens gives me 20/20 vision, and it's
that's incredible, isn't it?
So it's like another artificial cornea that on top of my cornea just creates, the right surface and the optics for me to see.
So are you able to drive, to read without glasses, to navigate life with perfect vision because of those lenses?
With my lenses in, with my lens. I only wear it in my left eye.
Only in the left eye.
So my right eye, the cataract, I think in a funny way, it was quite fortuitous. And although I hated the fact that I suddenly had another experience of going blind again because it was so dense and it couldn't be operated on because of the stitches. My ophthalmologist wouldn't touch it until all my sutures were out. And then he said, we wait 3 months after that.
And then tackle
and
the cataract.
And then we'll tackle the cataract. And, it was a hell of a frustrating. But he managed to put in such a super-duper intraocular lens. Yeah. It's a Heidelberg intraocular lens. And he had a second opinion, somebody taking measurements. And the vision out of my right eye is actually really crisp. Yeah.
So without any additional lenses. Okay. Incredible. I mean, you've just you told us a little bit about what you know of your donor from the US for your left eye. I mean, so obviously you've been given some information about where that donor tissue came from.
Yes.
How much are you allowed to know? Have you had any opportunity, for example, to write to your donor's families to acknowledge the donation?
Yeah, I have. Written to the families. I haven't had any response, and I wouldn't have anticipated any response.
Okay.
It really is a case of contacting the eye bank and acknowledging, you know, that you'd had the transplant on X date. And I didn't ever know their names. Mm. I just knew the circumstances. So my right eye was a 25-year-old young boy who was killed in a car accident. Mm. Also an American guy. So I did write to the families and share my story, but It's up to them as to whether they want to make contact or not.
Yeah, and I know, I mean, obviously there are very good reasons why that process is kept at sort of arm's length from one another, but did it mean a lot to you to be able to do that? Because, I mean, Amanda, let's talk about what that donation meant for your life and the change it's brought in your life.
Yeah, Pippa, you know, that's like a... Without that, I would be blind. I was thinking about it on the way into the studio this morning. Without those two gifts, I would be living as a disabled person today, walking with a cane and with a guide dog, and life would be very, very different. So to make that shift and transition back to being able to see again, being able to drive again, being able to restart my business now. Your eyes are, boy, think about what you do with your eyes all the time. And how much of a connection they allow you to make with people, with communities, with your safety, everything. So, it's a big, big deal in my life, you know. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just sitting here imagining this, the sense of vulnerability you must have had, knowing that you were dependent on other people for so much in that period while you were getting to diagnosis and proceeding with the transplant. To look at you now, fully independent, you know, in charge of your life, forging ahead, it's remarkable that it's possible. I mean, Amanda, you weren't just grateful for what was given to you. You've been so moved by this experience and reflective on this experience that you've founded an NGO called Eyes to Eyes, which tries to pay it forward, I guess you can say, by helping restore sight to others. Won't you just tell us a little bit about what Eyes to Eyes is all about and what you, I mean, you've just hit, I know, 40 patients that you've helped with those amazing scleral lenses you've told us about. Tell us a bit more.
Sure. So friends and I got together and I managed to bully them into joining the board of the NGO, because that's always a challenge, finding board members. They were both two individuals who'd had their own challenges in life along the way and had a sense of, you know, challenging times are life-changing and it makes you really sort of philosophical and think deep about what you've got and how much you need to give back. And they've been two amazing guys to have with me and as part of the team. And with the aid of my ophthalmologist, who's our medical advisor, we decided to start this foundation. And our initial focus was on this desperate need to raise money for a confocal microscope, which I'm going to talk about over and over again because one day somebody's going to hear me and somebody's going to fund it. But a confocal microscope is a very much needed piece of screening equipment that allows in vivo, in-person screening of all five layers of the cornea, and that will facilitate accurate and early diagnosis of exactly what's going on. And there's so much information you can get from a confocal scan.
Right.
And we don't have one in the Western Cape. There's one in private practice in Johannesburg. There isn't a single confocal anywhere else in South Africa.
Gosh.
It's an expensive piece of equipment. It comes in at R1 million. And we are still actively talking to corporate donors and trusts to see if we can get money into purchase one of those, which would sit probably at Grootegeluk Cornea Clinic.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'd love to try and figure out how we could make it accessible to private patients as well, because it's such a highly advanced piece of machinery. And there are probably people in private who would need to have confocal scans done. So
just as much as in public.
I'm not sure how one bridges that, but we would, we hope that we can do it somehow as almost a private public partnership. So that was the first goal. And then we had done a little bit of fundraising, had a music concert, and just through friends had raised some money. And we had money in the bank. And I said to the guys, this feels like it should be better utilized while we're waiting for the confocal. What about talking about a scleral lens program for Grootegeluk, where there are no scleral lenses being fitted?
Yeah, because they're very expensive, aren't they?
They're very expensive, and the reason for that is that they come in from New Zealand.
Okay.
So we do not have the type of lathe in South Africa to make such specialized lenses. And in terms of describing their specialization or their customization, you can almost think of them as a fingerprint. So they are custom molded to sit comfortably on over your diseased cornea. They can't ever touch the cornea. They almost have to sort of levitate a certain distance away from the cornea. And this machine that is used in New Zealand to make them allows for customization on multiple parameters. So they can, you know, even the edges can be lifted. It can be very quadrant specific in terms of its design. So you're getting something that's not going to cause any more damage to the person's cornea and also gives them brilliant sight. Exactly. Because you don't want a lens that's going to be rubbing a cone on a patient who's got keratoconus.
Yeah.
It's going to cause ulceration and also discomfort. So you don't want to fit a lens that a young child is going to say, Mom, I don't want to wear them
because they're not comfortable.
It makes my eyes sore and actually I can only see a little bit better. So getting a very specific lens for patients with advanced disease is important.
Yeah.
There may be other patients in Cape Town or in South Africa who can benefit from the locally produced lenses, but we're dealing with advanced cases of corneal disease where you're talking about, you know, 2% vision, maybe 10% vision, and the locally made lenses at the moment, unfortunately, just don't do it for them. Yeah.
So in the years you've been operating, you've managed to help 40 patients obtain those lenses.
Yes.
And Amanda, I mean, we were chatting earlier about some of the sort of the case studies, and obviously without breaking anybody's confidentiality, you're talking about a high school student who's able to move from a school for the blind back into mainstream schooling to finish her matric.
Exactly.
A musician who's able to read sheet music for the first time again.
Yeah.
I mean, these are life-changing interventions. Mm. You must feel incredibly proud of what you've achieved.
Yeah, I think now we're starting to feel, wow, this is getting traction, and we can look back and be very grateful for forging ahead, because it's fundraising is hard work in anybody's book, in any sector, and eyes are not a sexy subject. You know, they're not an easy sell. The story of blindness is quite a hard one to tell to potential funders.
Yeah.
And there's very much a focus, quite naturally in South Africa, on gender-based violence, early childhood development. There's so many needs. People needing food. So understandably, organizations, trusts, companies need to prioritize where they're putting their money. And, you know, the global economic situation hasn't exactly helped. With disbursement of funds. But yes, we are. We really are pleased with where we are now, but we also are determined that we're going to keep going and start getting more people their sight back and grow Eyes to Eyes into something that's very sustainable and possibly can branch out into looking at cataract services down the line as well. Yeah.
Amanda, the other thing you do through Eyes to Eyes is continually drive the message that you referenced earlier, that there's so few donors in South Africa, that there could be so many more, and to drive the message around organ and tissue donation and what that entails. As you mentioned, you had to get donor tissue all the way from the USA. Obviously, that comes at inflated cost.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be amazing if all the need could be met right here in South Africa? I noticed on the Eyes to Eyes website that you talk about having to debunk myths around cornea donation as one of the stumbling blocks. Can you explain a bit more?
Yeah, so there are a lot of myths around how the corneas are procured, for example.
Yeah.
People assume that their loved one's eyeballs are going to be removed. And so there's a fear of, you know, you're now going to be sending your loved one into the afterlife with without their eyes and defaced, if you like. Okay. Actually, it's a very, very gentle procedure where just that front clear window of your eye is removed. Mm. A little shield is gently placed over the eye and you wouldn't even know that the corneas have been removed. So,
With tissue donation, as with organ donation, Amanda, in the end, it's the family who makes that decision. I mean, you've referenced the fact that you were already registered as an organ and tissue donor before the start of this whole journey. Mm. Even so, one day when the time comes, it won't be you who makes the decision that your corneas, kidneys, lungs, heart, etc., could be used by somebody else. It'll be your loved ones, exactly. Your next of kin.
Exactly. And that's a vital conversation to have. Mm. So they need to be aware of it and they need to be on board. And they're the ones who are going to say yay or nay. Mm.
Just in closing, I mean, here we are. It's now 2023, which means we sort of 4 years post-transplant and 6 years, no, 5 years post the beginning of this whole journey for you. What is your message to somebody who's thinking about it but maybe not sure about whether they want to register as an organ and tissue donor, about where to go for information, about reassuring them about taking that step? What would you say based on what you've gone through to that person who hasn't committed yet?
I think that, yeah, one of the first things I'd like to say is organ procurement and the actual process of your organs being transferred to another person is such a dignified process. And don't get caught up in the sort of fear of it being, of there being money trade involved, of being, you know, doctors not giving you the correct treatment because, you know, they're wanting your organs, which are all these weird stories that go around. We're talking about life, and we're talking about giving somebody a future and somebody who desperately needs something that you really are not going to use when you're dead. You know, to put it that simply.
Yeah.
And what an incredible gift, whether it's a heart or a lung or corneas or kidney, to be able to actually give someone the capacity to live out their best life and a full life. What more could you want to leave behind? You know, it's just such an incredible legacy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of A Gift of Life. Please check out our website, capetalk.co.za, to follow the series in full and make sure you don't miss an episode. And I'd really like to encourage you to share these episodes with your own family and friends. Help start the conversation about organ donation in your circles of influence. If you'd like to register as a donor, please visit the Organ Donor Foundation on www.odf.org.za. It's a quick, easy, and free process, and it could save 7 lives.